Morning. My watch shows 9 o'clock, ready to start. We are on lesson 3 of the book of Daniel. We haven't quite made it to chapter 1 yet, but we are getting closer. I think we probably have today and next week as continue our introduction, and then we should get to chapter 1. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're so thankful for this beautiful day you've given us, this day to come and worship you, to study your word. Father, we're so thankful for your word that you've given us. Father, we're thankful that it is the truth, Father, that it is powerful, that it is relevant. We know it is under attack, Father, but our prayer is that we will continue to proclaim it and defend it and hold it up to this lost and dying world. And Father, most of all, we're thankful for your Son, the Word made flesh, our Savior and our King, and we pray these things in his name. Amen. Last week, we began by discussing the relation between Daniel and Revelation. And we discussed how those two books are bookends. Daniel looking forward in history through the kingdoms that were there and that would follow, the Chaldeans, Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and Rome. And then Revelation looking backward, starting at Rome, back through the Greeks, the Medo-Persians, back to the Chaldeans. We then started talking about the big controversy regarding the book of Daniel. And that controversy is, when was the book of Daniel written? We looked at the two views, the early view and the late view. And we discussed the view that we'll be taking in this class, which is the early view, that the book was written when it says it was written, by whom it was says it was written by. And we also then started looking at the evidence for that view. The most important evidence, of course, is that Jesus referred to Daniel in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 as a prophet. And more than just that, Jesus said that some of the things that Daniel spoke about had not yet happened, but would happen in the first century lives of his listeners. Matthew 24, verse 34. Which tells us that Daniel did speak about Rome. He did have some things to say about the Roman Empire, even though the modern liberal critic would tell us he did not. We then looked at some examples of historical accuracies in Daniel that would be very difficult to explain had Daniel been written centuries after the fact. And as we ended class last time, we were just starting to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is some of the most important evidence for the historical accuracy and date, early date, of the book of Daniel. It's been said that history does not repeat itself. Historians just repeat each other. And I don't think there's anywhere more true of that statement than when it comes to ancient history. Many historians adhere blindly to their dogma, historical dogma, with regard to what the evidence, without regard really to what the evidence shows. They're just going to adhere to their dogma. Let me give you an example of that. Historians have long proclaimed, and I'm sure many still do, most probably still do, that modern man, having emerged from the slime, progressed slowly on the evolutionary ladder, and then finally, millennia later, began to form cities and civilizations, etc. The Bible, of course, teaches something very different than that. The Bible tells us that mankind has always been civilized. The Bible tells us that mankind has always had language from day one. And the Bible tells us that cities have existed shortly after day one, starting in Genesis 4:17, where we see the mention of the city that Cain built. Well, which of those two views is best supported by the evidence? If anyone ever asks you that question, here are two words to tell them. Göbekli Tepe. That's an ancient stone complex that's been dug up in Turkey, about 500 miles from Istanbul. It is huge, huge. It's twice as old as the Great Pyramids. It's thousands of years older than Stonehenge. It's been called the most astonishing archaeological discovery in modern times, and it's been called perhaps the oldest advanced civilization on Earth. And perhaps most astonishing of all about Göbekli Tepe, but perhaps not astonishing to students of the Bible, is that it is located about 200-300 miles from Mount Ararat. And those carvings in Göbekli Tepe, they're animals. All sorts of animals. They've got bulls, foxes, cranes, lions, ducks, scorpions, ants, spiders, snakes, all sorts of animals they're digging up over there. That one discovery is causing the modern liberal historian to have to rewrite their textbooks. Rewrite them. It's an amazing discovery. You ought to take a look at that. But if we move back to Daniel, we talked about another amazing discovery last time. And again, one that causes the modern liberal historian to have to rewrite their textbooks. For many years, they argued that Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 5 never existed. Just a clear example of historical inaccuracy in the book of Daniel. There's no record of him. He wasn't king. He never existed. Nothing about Belshazzar. But then they found an inscription, and there was his name, Belshazzar. And if you look at your handout on box D, if you don't have a handout, there's some in the back, but there's a box D here. That is called the Nabonidus Cylinder. Nabonidus was Belshazzar's father. You can see that in box F, which we'll get to later. And on that cylinder is a prayer that Nabonidus gave for his son, Belshazzar. Guard me from offending against your divinity. Give me long life. Cause Belshazzar, my eldest son, to revere your great Godhead. Is written right there on that cylinder they dug up. And once they dug that up, well, you know that argument that Belshazzar never existed? Gonna have to go back and find another one. They did, but that one's no good anymore. You don't see that anymore in the modern liberal historian commentaries. Never bet against the Bible. You'll lose every single time. Archaeology has confirmed the biblical accounts over and over and over. And again, there's one of the most startling examples of where that's true is the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the spring of 1947, in the Judean wilderness near the Dead Sea, they found these ancient manuscripts in these jars that have caused historians to rewrite their understanding of that time and of the text of the Bible. We found text of the Old Testament that went back 1,000 years earlier than what we had before that time. There are a number of stories of how the scrolls were discovered. Most of them involve an Arab boy named Muhammad Adib, Muhammad the Wolf. And one story has it that he was herding goats in the area and he tosses a rock and he hears it hit a jar and he goes in to investigate. Another story has it that he is smuggling goods across the Jordan and takes refuge in the cave. My suspicion is the latter story is the truth and the former story was used for publication, but who knows. The scrolls were brought to Bethlehem, the nearest market town. He tried to sell them. At that time, that whole area, is still true today, was divided into armed camps. And so it was very hard to dispose of them, but they were sold in two lots, one to Hebrew University and one to a Syrian Orthodox monastery. The monastery later sold them to the Hebrew University for about $250,000 at that time. All of the scrolls from the initial cave, which is called Cave 1, are now located in the Shrine of the Book, it's called, adjacent to Hebrew University. They do leave occasionally. They were in Houston in 2005 at the Museum of Natural Science. If you weren't able to go see them, if they ever come back, please, please go see them. They don't get out of Jerusalem very often. Some of the copies, as I mentioned, were 1,000 years older than any that existed prior to that find that we had. Before that find, our earliest complete copy of the Hebrew Old Testament was the Leningrad Codex from AD 916. It's about 1,000 years after the date of these that were found. 13 copies of Deuteronomy. 12 copies of Isaiah, 10 copies of the Psalms were found in those caves. In Luke 4:17, Jesus is handed a copy, a scroll of Isaiah. You'll recall he reads that. It says, today this was fulfilled in your hearing. Those copies of scrolls of Isaiah that were found in those Dead Sea, that's contemporary with that scroll that Jesus held in his hand. To date, they found 11 caves and have produced at least 400 manuscripts. The scrolls have had a tremendous impact on the textual study of the Bible, and they have overwhelmingly confirmed the accuracy of the text that we have. Overwhelmingly confirmed it. They have overwhelmingly shown us the providential care of God in giving us His Word throughout the ages and preserving that Word throughout the ages. Well, why hasn't that been more widely reported? I mean, why don't we hear more about that, that these scrolls are confirming the textual accuracy of God's Word? Well, let me turn that question around. What if in those caves they had uncovered copies of Isaiah that were dramatically, drastically different from what we have? Psalms that were dramatically, drastically different from what we have. Would that have been reported? Yeah. It would have been reported in 1947. It would still be making headline news today. But just the opposite was true. They dramatically confirmed the accuracy and the fidelity of the text. And so, no reporting of that. Hardly a word about it. Just one example before we get back to Daniel of how the scrolls confirm the Bible's integrity. There's a very popular theory among liberal critics still today that Isaiah is really three books written by three different people and all kind of glued together. But before the Dead Sea Scrolls, there was even a more radical version of that, and that is that the last half of Isaiah from chapter 40 on was really written in the first century. That it didn't even go back beyond the first century. That's how recent it was, is what they argued. Keep in mind that includes Isaiah 53, which is one of the most remarkable prophecies in the Bible about Christ. And they were trying to say, oh, well, that was written in the first century. Well, guess what? When they dug up the Dead Sea Scrolls and found those scrolls of Isaiah, there was no break between chapter 39 and 40. It was all there. Another beautiful theory shot down by, I'm sure, what he thought an ugly fact. He didn't like that fact, but that fact blew that theory right out of the water. And in fact, it also blows out of the water the idea that Isaiah is all these books glued together. There was no break there. It's one book. Another example. Seven copies of Daniel, dating from the time of those scrolls have been found. In three of the caves at Qumran is where they were found. The fact that they had seven copies in three caves makes it so incredibly unlikely. Just that fact alone makes it incredibly unlikely that Daniel was written at that same time. That somehow it was written and then suddenly it made its way into all those caves and all those repositories. No, that points to an ancient source for Daniel. Much earlier source. Because it's found with Isaiah and Psalms and all the other Old Testament books. The late date group, those who hold to the late date for Daniel, they have to somehow explain how these Essenes, and that's who lived in Qumran where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, they have to somehow explain how they had near original copies of Daniel that, according to their theory, had just been written a few years earlier. Of course, a simpler explanation is that Daniel was not written just a few years earlier. It had been written centuries earlier, as it says itself. There were a lot of non-biblical manuscripts in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They weren't all from the Bible. There were a lot of different types of manuscripts. And one of them refers to Daniel the prophet. Would that make any sense at all if Daniel had just been written a few years earlier? That fragment has been dated prior to 150 B.C. The late date group says Daniel was written around 160 B.C. Another sectarian document they found from the caves uses the same imagery we see in Daniel to refer to the final conflict between good and evil. I think any honest scholar looking at the evidence of the Dead Sea Scrolls would have to accept the early date, but the modern liberal scholar is unable to do that. Because remember what we said, if you take the date of Daniel and move it from here to here, then suddenly Daniel contains incredible predictive prophecies of all this history in between. They cannot have that. The liberal critic cannot have that. No matter what the evidence shows, they will not move the date of Daniel. No matter what the evidence shows. And nowhere is that more clear when we look at the evidence of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The linguistic evidence of the scrolls overwhelmingly supports an early date for Daniel. Let me tell you what I mean. Look at your handout again. Look at boxes A, B, and C. I pulled these three excerpts out of three commentaries on the book of Daniel. One of these boxes, one of these commentaries, was written in 1755. One of them was written in 1864, and one of them was written in 2011. Let's start with the easy one. Which one was written in 2011? B, exactly. You can tell that from a number of ways, right? The language is something that looks very modern, But notice it also talks about a camera, the focus of the camera, giving an example there. So we can look at the language, we can look at the word use, we can look at the style, we can look at the words that are used. A lot of different ways we can tell that B is a very recent, or certainly more recent than the other two. Which is the oldest, A or C?
A.
Much older, right? In fact, you can see they're still using what looks to us like an F for S in the type setting. It's much older. In fact, that's the one from 1755. That's about the same time as that commentary by Isaac Newton that I mentioned to you last time. Well, that leaves C as 1864. We can certainly get that by process of elimination. Is there any other way we could have gotten that from C? And we'll look at it. It says, that part of Scripture which especially treats, that's not a modern way of using especially, right? And then keep going, whilst the ancient people of God, it's using some old words, right, that we don't use today. So we can tell that's an older commentary also. Those scholars studying the Dead Sea Scrolls can do the same thing with the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? They can look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they understand Hebrew and Aramaic, and they can look at the Dead Sea Scrolls in Greek, and they can do the same kind of analysis and say, well, here's a scroll that looks like it's really old. I can tell by looking at the word use and the syntax and the language and the sentence structure and all this morphology and all this stuff they look at. This is really, really old. And they can look at another one and say, wow, this one's pretty close to what we see over here, so this is much... They can do that with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And when they do, what do you think they find? Daniel looks like box A. Daniel looks old. The wording, the vocabulary, the structure, the sentences of Daniel look very old compared to what else they find at that time. So they can do the same kind of analysis. With the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have scrolls that are unquestionably... Some that are unquestionably written at the time. In other words, we have some that to those people would look like box C, that were contemporaneous with them at the time. But then we have Daniel, which looks much more like box A, centuries earlier than that. That evidence shows that Daniel is linguistically older by centuries than the other writings we have at that time. If anyone ever tells you that a Christian faith is a blind faith, that Christians with that blind faith simply believe and ignore all evidence to the contrary, if anyone ever tells you that, I want you to tell them about Daniel and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I want you to take them straight to it. Say, well, let's talk about ignoring the evidence. Let's talk about adhering blindly to a dogma, and then take them to Daniel and the Dead Sea Scrolls. If they want to see an example of blind faith in action, they need to look at how the modern liberal critic deals with Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, I've had people tell me that before, that I have a blind faith, that I ignore the evidence. I have never had anyone tell me that twice. Let's look at some other evidence. The book of Ezekiel also supports the early view. In Ezekiel 14, verse 14, and in Ezekiel 14, verse 20, Daniel is listed alongside Noah and Job as an example of righteousness. In Ezekiel 28, verse 3, Bible says, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. This representation of Daniel as a righteous, wise person. Of course, we know, we haven't even studied the book yet, but we already know that fits perfectly with the Daniel we're going to study about in the book of Daniel. Now, most modern scholars accept an early date for Ezekiel. So how do they then explain Ezekiel's references to Daniel if Daniel wasn't written for centuries after Ezekiel was written? Well, they come up with an interesting explanation for that. They say that Ezekiel is not referring to Daniel at all. Instead, he's referring to Dan-El, a famous character from Ugaritic mythology. Is it even remotely believable that Ezekiel, in mentioning Job, in mentioning Noah, would then suddenly jump outside of the Hebrew Bible to some mythology and talk about someone named Daniel as an example of righteousness. Well, let's at least pause to see, well, was Daniel an example of righteousness? Well, he was an idol worshiper. He offered blood sacrifices to Baal for weeks at a time. He was a vengeful drunkard. He convinced his daughter to commit murder. Well, that sure sounds like an example of righteousness, doesn't it? Well, they then turn that around. They say, well, look, Daniel was a contemporary of Ezekiel. They lived around the same time. So does it really make sense they say that Ezekiel would point to a contemporary as an example of righteousness? Well, why not? If he's an example of righteousness, I mean, why not? Daniel was very widely known. As we study this book, we're going to see how well known he must have been at that time. So why not point to him? And in fact, one commentator noted that Noah, Job, and Daniel are very likely spaced about 1,500 years apart. So maybe Ezekiel was pointing to three different eras for righteousness. But for whatever reason, Ezekiel wrote that through inspiration. He's talking about Daniel, our Daniel, the Daniel from the book of Daniel. And he's writing about it at the time that this book was written, centuries before the liberal scholar says it was. Another piece of evidence is a non-biblical book called the First Book of Maccabees, which was written around the 160 BC time frame. In this book, Mattathias, who was the father of the Jewish patriot Maccabean brothers, that's how this gets the Maccabean age, he encouraged his sons to revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes. And how did he encourage them? In this book, he encouraged them by recalling how Daniel, for his innocence, was saved from the mouths of the lions. Well, you know what? Mattathias died in 166 BC, which was a year before when the modern liberal critic says Daniel was written. So how do they explain that one? Oh, they say Mattathias never said that. That must have been written later. They've always got an explanation. It doesn't make sense, but they've got one. Josephus. We've all heard about Josephus. Josephus overwhelmingly supports the early view for the book of Daniel. In Josephus' book, Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus relates a story, an amazing, astonishing story, that if true, I mean, Josephus, of course, is not inspired, so we don't know if it's true. But if true, it would prove that Daniel existed during the time of Alexander the Great, which was 330 B.C. In fact, I think it would show it existed much earlier than that, because we know it was written much earlier than that. But here's what Josephus tells us. Josephus tells us that Alexander the Great was very angry that the Jews would not give him their allegiance. So Alexander the Great marched his armies to Jerusalem to punish them. Josephus tells us that the Jewish priest met Alexander the Great at the camp, right outside the city, and showed him the book of Daniel. That's what Josephus tells us, that they showed Alexander the Great the book of Daniel and pointed him to the part in Daniel where it says that he, Alexander the Great, would defeat the Persians. Josephus says they pointed that out to Alexander the Great. And according to Josephus, that pleased Alexander so much that he spared the city of Jerusalem. Here's what Josephus wrote. The high priest then showed Alexander the passages in the prophecy of Daniel, indicating that a Greek would destroy the empire of the Persians. Alexander, of course, accepted the prophecy as a reference to himself and declared that God had ordained him to conquer Persia, which he proceeded to do. Furthermore, Alexander not only refused to execute any sanctions against Israel, but bestowed upon that nation all kinds of favors and benefits, which was contrary to his usual custom. Yeah, I would say it was contrary to his usual custom. He usually left them a parking lot. That's what he did with Tyre and Sidon. Why didn't he do that with Jerusalem? History confirms that Alexander marched near Jerusalem on his way to Egypt. History confirms that Alexander the Great treated the Jews kindly. How else can we explain that? Except, as Josephus tells us, it happened. Alexander spared Jerusalem the ravages that he inflicted on other cities. Why? Josephus tells us why. Because they showed him the book of Daniel. The consequences of that, Of course, it would completely destroy the liberal modern view of when Daniel was written, because it would have Daniel existing at the time that happened, which was 334 BC, and certainly much earlier than that if the Jews of that day were able to have it, understand it, and know it, and show it to Alexander. Josephus tells us a lot more than that, though. Josephus tells us that the entire Jewish canon, including Daniel, was completed before 424 BC. That's not just his opinion. That was the Jewish national opinion at the time. He also speaks of many other books that were not part of that canon, that were rejected, but not Daniel. Daniel was there. It was in the Jewish canon of Scripture long before the modern liberal scholar says it was written. Well, how do the critics respond to all that? Of course, they reject Josephus. They say he just made that up. It's amazing how they treat Josephus, though. Anytime Josephus supports them or anytime they agree with Josephus, they just enthusiastically accept him as the great historian of the day. But anytime he disagrees with them, oh, that hack, he doesn't know what he's writing about. Another piece of evidence. The use of a two-horned ram to symbolize Medo-Persia. That supports an early date for the book. Now, why is that? Why would the use of a particular symbol support a particular date for a book? Well, let me ask you this. You pick up a history textbook, and it's describing the Eisenhower administration. And it's describing how wonderful the Eisenhower administration was. And it says, you know, the Eisenhower administration, it was so wonderful, it was like the days of Camelot. Now, are you going to think, okay, well, that book must have been written before the Kennedy administration, right? Aren't you going to think that? Because today, if you say which presidency was described as the age of Camelot, you're immediately going to think the Kennedy administration. That's what they all described it as, the wonderful age of Camelot. So if you read a history textbook that's describing some other presidency that way, you're immediately going to think, well, that has to have been written before the Kennedy administration, because, you know, if it were written afterwards, they never would have taken the Camelot and applied it to somebody else. That's what's going on in Daniel. That's what's going on in Daniel. After Alexander the Great went to Egypt, he was forever depicted on coins with ram's horns on his head. The ram's horns of Amun-Ra, the Egyptian false god. In fact, 1,000 years later, Muhammad would call him Alexander, the Lord of the Two Horns. That stuck with him. One commentator has written, "It is impossible to believe that the writer of Daniel could, in the face of universal attribution of the two ram's horns to Alexander, represent Persia, the power he overthrew, using a two-horned ram," which is what Daniel does in Daniel chapter 8, verses 3 and verse 20, "unless he had written that before Alexander went to Egypt." Well, if we believe Josephus, we know Daniel was written before Alexander went to Egypt, because Alexander stopped by on his way to Egypt and read the thing. We know it was written earlier. But if it had been written afterwards, they would never have used that figure to apply to Medo-Persia. They would have used it probably for Alexander. So again, just looking at the text, we see evidence of an early date. Let's look now at the other side of this coin. And we do need to look at both sides of the coin. The other side of the coin is, what are our responses to the late date arguments? And they've got some arguments. So we need to look at them and respond to them. I mean, it might be tempting just to skip over them. We know when it's written, we've now seen evidence for it, and go on to the first chapter. But we need to stop and look at what they say. One, we certainly shouldn't run from it. I mean, we know the truth, so we need to look at what they say and explain it and understand why it's wrong. But second, if we're talking to friends or skeptics about this book, this is what they're going to dig up off of Wikipedia or somewhere and bring to us. We're going to have to know how to respond to it so that we can answer their questions. So let's look at some of the arguments on the other side, and let's see why they're wrong and why they don't point to a late date. Here's the first argument they've got. They say that Daniel's position in the Jewish scriptures, you know, where it's located in the Jewish scriptures, points to a late date. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, it's divided into three sections. The Law, books of Moses. The Prophets, which includes Joshua and Judges, but also 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets. And what they call the Writings. Psalm, Proverbs, Job, Song of Solomon, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, 1 and 2 Chronicles. Those are called the Holy Writings, three sections. Well, in some ways, there's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason to how these fell into various sections. You'll notice 1 and 2 Kings is in one section, 1 and 2 Chronicles in another section. But the liberal critics argue, well, Daniel's found not in the second section with the prophets. It's found over here in the third section with the writings. And they say that means it must have been a very late addition to the Jewish canon. Well, first, I've already mentioned, Josephus tells us the Jewish canon was closed around 424 B.C. So even making it a late addition, if it were a late addition, would not push it to 168 B.C. But it's a big mistake to assume that the books in the third division were written after the books in the second division. In fact, Job, Ruth, Proverbs, and the Psalms are in the third division. We know many of those, probably all of those, were written before a lot of the prophetical books. In fact, some people point to Job as being one of the oldest books we have in the Bible. Jewish tradition says that Malachi is not just the last book in the Bible, in the Old Testament, but they say it was also the last written book in the Old Testament. Certainly it was written later than many of the others. And it's in the second division, which would mean if it was the last book, the second division was closed after the third division was closed. Well, why do we even have these divisions in the Hebrew Bible? Well, you know, one explanation is they may be based on the people that wrote them rather than the type of book. The first division is written by Moses. The second division were written by prophets that had the official office of a prophet. And then third were those prophets that didn't have the official office of a prophet. What do I mean by officially a prophet? Well, you'll notice Daniel's a little different than a lot of the other books of prophecy, the prophets that we have. Daniel doesn't introduce the book with his name. He doesn't seem to have an official prophetic office among the Jewish people. In fact, Daniel really deals more with the pagans, right? He's dealing with the pagan kings and those people. He is called a prophet by Jesus, of course, as we've already looked at. But then David's also called a prophet in the New Testament, Acts 2, verse 30. So I think that may be the explanation or an explanation. But in any event, that argument by the liberal critics proved nothing. It doesn't prove that at all, what they think it shows. I like what one commentator said about this. He said, "Now the radical critics, without any direct evidence to support them, profess to believe that into the midst of these sacred writings, for which men readily died, a forged document of unknown authorship, and according to the critics, full of easily detected errors, was quietly admitted as a genuine and authentic writing of a prophet hitherto unknown to history. They cannot believe in miracles and predictive prophecy, but they can believe that a lot of obstreperous and cantankerous Jews who through all of their history, from Jacob and Esau down to the present time, have disagreed and quarreled about almost everything or nothing, could have accepted unanimously and without a murmur a forged and fictitious document untrue to the well-remembered facts of their own experience." I mean, it's ludicrous to think that this book, if they say it was written in 168 B.C., would just have been stuck into the Jewish canon and accepted by all. It is ludicrous. And yet that's what they want us to believe. Paul reminds us in Romans 3, verse 2, that the Jews were entrusted with the very words of God. And believe me, they took that responsibility seriously. They still do today. And that's one of the reasons we have such a well-preserved text, is because of that responsibility that they took so seriously in preserving it throughout the years. Second argument they make, they say there's a man named Jesus ben Sirach. And they say, well, he didn't mention Daniel, and so therefore written late. Well, let's look at this argument. Jesus ben Sirach, he wrote a book called Ecclesiasticus, not Ecclesiastes, but another one. He wrote it between 200 and 170 B.C. And at the end of that book, he reviews Israel's history. mentioning some of the men that God had used to lead Israel. And he does not mention Daniel. In fact, at one point, he writes that never had there ever been born a man like Joseph. And the liberal says, well, there you go. He must not have known about Daniel. Because they say Daniel and Joseph had a lot in common. Right? They were both exiles. They both showed their allegiance to God. They were both falsely accused. They were both vindicated. They both interpreted dreams. They both became confidants to the king. Both were given high government positions. And there this guy is writing around 200 BC saying there'd never been anybody like Joseph. And they say, well, that means it was written after that. Well, let's go back and look a little more carefully at that. First, Daniel's not the only person omitted from that list. Jonah's not on the list. Mordecai's not on the list. Ezra's not on the list. Job's not on the list. No one ever uses that to argue Ezra wasn't written when he says it was written. I think one commentator has it right. He says it's a remarkable fact that this Jesus ben Sirach does not pay any regard to the great men who had exercised their functions outside the land of Israel. He was a nationalist. That was what was going on at the time. These historians need to pick up the history book and read it, and then they'd understand why Jesus ben Sirach left Daniel off. He was a nationalist, and he didn't want to mention anybody that was outside the nation, the land of Israel. Well, Daniel was off working with kings in Babylon. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And in fact, even when speaking of Joseph, we already mentioned he mentions Joseph. He never mentions Egypt. He never, Joseph ben Sirach, he never says anything about Egypt. He mentions Joseph, says nothing about Egypt. He was totally focused on the land, the nationalistic land that he was living on. That explains why he did not mention Daniel. Next argument. They say, look, you know, Daniel is just mistaken about history. And they say, it starts off in the first verse, they say. Let's go ahead and flip over there. We're not actually starting chapter 1 yet, but I do want to go over there and look at verses 1 through 3. They say, look, the mistakes in Daniel, let's start off with the first verse, and they say Daniel's mistaken about when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. And they say that means Daniel must have been written many, many years after the fact. Well, look there at Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 3. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people to Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility. Okay. The liberal critic says there are a number, they allege a number of problems here. They say, first, well, the Babylonian Chronicle, which was the history that we've now dug up from the time, they say it makes no reference to any action by Nebuchadnezzar in Judah during the third year of Jehoiakim or to a siege of Jerusalem at that time. And in fact, according to Jeremiah 46, verse 2, the battle that opened the way for the Babylonian invasion of Judah did not occur until the fourth year of Jehoiakim's reign, where Daniel 1:1 says it was besieged in the third year of the reign. So we need to look at three questions here. When did Nebuchadnezzar arrive at Jerusalem to besiege it? Two, when did he defeat Jerusalem? And three, when did he carry away the captives and the sacred vessels? Well, first, 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, record three separate occasions when Nebuchadnezzar carried away people and articles from the temple. 2 Kings 23, verse 36, through 24, verse 5. In those verses, in the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles, Jehoiakim gave allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar for 3 years, and then he rebelled. Nebuchadnezzar defeated Jehoiakim's forces, and he took Jehoiakim back in chains, along with some of the items from the temple. That's the first time. Second time, we'll read about in 2 Kings 24, verse 8 and following. Jehoiakim succeeded Jehoiakim and reigned for 3 months while the servants of Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. Again, the siege was successful, and Jehoiakim and much of the nobility were deported to Babylon. That's number two. Number three, we read about in 2 Kings 24:17 and following. Zedekiah rules for a few years and then rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. In the ninth year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar again besieges Jerusalem, which fell in the 11th year of his reign. The city was destroyed. Most of the leading men were killed. Others were deported. All the articles from the temple were taken. So this wasn't just a one-time bang and it's over. It happened over a number of years and a number of different events, as all described to us in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. I think the best and most likely explanation is that Daniel 1:1-4 is really intended to kind of be a brief summary of all that had happened to that time. Just kind of bring the reader up to date as to how we're here. You know, why are these people in Babylon? How did we get here? They knew this was already recorded in 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles. They didn't need to go back through all the history. I think it's just bringing everyone up to speed as to why we're here, why we're in this city. But I think there are some other important things to note here. One, the text doesn't say Jerusalem was captured, does it? It says it was besieged. Listen to what one liberal critic said about it. Daniel begins with a glaring historical error, for Nebuchadnezzar did not take Jerusalem in the third year of King Jehoiakim. Okay, wait, we just read that. Where did it say he took it? It says he was besieged. That's different than taking the city. It says he besieged the city. Daniel never says that Jerusalem was captured at that time, only besieged. And in fact, history tells us that in the middle of his Palestinian campaign, Nebuchadnezzar received news of his father's death. So he rushed back to Babylon to assume the throne, apparently abandoning the siege at that time. So there were events where the city was besieged and not taken. But there's another interesting thing here, which I think also supports the early view for when Daniel was written. The Babylonians used a different dating system. At first glance, Daniel 1:1 seems to be in conflict with Jeremiah 25:1, because one says something happened in the third year and the other says something happened in the fourth year. But Jeremiah was writing in Jerusalem and Daniel was writing in Babylon, and those two places used different dating systems, and they were different in two different respects. The Babylonian calendar began in the spring of each year, and the Jewish calendar began in the autumn of each year. That means for at least 6 months, the two were off. In other words, for 6 months of the year, I'd be saying it's the third year if I were here, and I'd be saying it's the fourth year if I'm over here. But they also had another difference. The Babylonian way of telling when a king came to power. When the king first came to power, there was something called a year of accession. And then the next year was called the first year of his reign, and then the second year and the third year. So if you looked at a king and he's really reigning for 2 years, you'd have a year of accession and then the first year of his reign. Either of those could explain the difference between Jeremiah and Daniel. But let's turn that around on him. How in the world would Daniel have known that if he were writing centuries after the fact? They also claim that Daniel uses terms that are different. You know, we saw one of those in one of these examples, the word camera. You know, if I'd shown you that in this old English script, you would have said, no, something's fishy about that. Talking about a camera back in the 70s, that would have been a little odd. And they say there's something like that in Daniel. And they say that the word that's like that in Daniel, they say, is the word Chaldean. That's kind of odd, because that's all throughout Daniel. How is that different? Well, if you look at Daniel 2:2, there, the word Chaldean is used a little differently than we've been using it. There, it's used to refer to a special class of wise men, the Chaldeans. Not the ethnic, national, tribal Chaldeans, but the special class of wise men called Chaldeans. And they say the fact that Daniel uses that term that way means it's much later. Well, we know the term had two different uses. It still does today. So the question is, well, when did that change happen? If that change happened at the time Daniel was writing, then yeah, he could use the same term in two different ways. In fact, that's what he did. When did that change happen? Well, the truth is, Daniel uses the term both ways. He uses it in the ethnic sense in Daniel 1:4. He uses it in a special sense, Daniel 2, Daniel 4, Daniel 5. Daniel was aware that the word Chaldean had two different uses. Herodotus, ancient historian, wrote the histories around 450 BC. He says that that term had been used for that special purpose as far back as the time of Cyrus, who lived during the time of Daniel. He's the one that came in and conquered the Chaldeans. That pushes the use of that term back to the time of Daniel. So the answer is, well, yeah, camera could be used because Daniel knew about cameras. I mean, not camera, but the Chaldeans. So that's not that use of that term is not out of context. It was proper for the time. And in fact, I like what one commentator said about that. He said, it's hard to prove a negative. Our knowledge of the Babylonian literature of the time of Daniel is not so complete that we can safely affirm that Chaldean never meant a certain class of wise men. In fact, we know it did in Daniel's time because he used it that way, as well as using it in its ethnic sense. We've already talked about Belshazzar, but the liberal critic says, of course, they said for a long time Belshazzar didn't exist. Now they say, okay, well, he did exist, but they say Daniel was wrong about what he said about Belshazzar. They say Daniel says Belshazzar was the king in Daniel 5. And the modern liberal critic says Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, was the last king of the Chaldeans. So they say there's a huge historical error in the book of Daniel. Next week we're going to start at this point. We're going to show that it's not a historical error. And we're going to again turn it around on them and show that how Daniel knew about Belshazzar and knew about Belshazzar's position there at the time of Daniel, how that firmly establishes the early view for the book of Daniel. You'll notice we have a theme here. We're looking at each of their arguments, we're showing why they're wrong, and we're turning them around on them to show they actually support our position. And that's going to be true of all of them. So when we get through with that, I think next week we will start with chapter 1. Let me say, if there are any, I know there are probably some questions on this, and I realize I'm going kind of fast, and it's more of a lecture style here in the introduction. But if you have any questions, please let me know, and I'll be happy to address them and answer them. Also, if you want to hear the audio of today's class, if you want a copy of the handout, or you want to hear the audio of the earlier classes, go to studydaniel.com. Studydaniel.com. Audio will all be posted. Thank you very much.